You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
India's economy is Asia's third largest, enjoying strong growth of 9% or more in the past 3 years. But like most of the world's economies today, it experienced a sharp slowdown over the last quarter of 2008. The global recession cut demand for exports, and economists fear dramatic measures may be required to boost growth. To help make sense of these political and economic challenges, Nandan Nilekani, co-founder of the IT company Infosys, has written Imagining India, the Idea of a Renewed Nation. It's published by Penguin Press, and I'm very pleased it has brought Mr. Nilekani to the show today. Hello.
Thank you.
When the economic slowdown began, many economists were suggesting that because India's economy is driven so much by domestic demand, it wouldn't suffer as much. Even the Indian government predicted that the growth would continue to surge. Did you agree with those more optimistic assessments?
Well, I think in the initial days, one did feel that India may be disconnected from the global slowdown, but it's very clear now that it's far more interdependent because India depends on global capital flows, India's exporters depend on global markets, and India's trade depends on global trade finance. So all these three things slow down. But overall, I think India is better placed because unlike many other countries in Asia, which have a very high export orientation, India has only about 17% of its GDP from exports and two-thirds of its GDP from domestic consumption. To that extent, yes, it is largely domestic consumption driven.
Well, the prologue to your book is written by New York Times columnist Tom Friedman, who's introducing you tomorrow night at the New York Public Library. And I gather that conversations between the two of you inspired his bestseller, The World is Flat. But are you suggesting that globalization is not as much of an issue for India as it is for most of the other countries that have strong economies these days?
Well, it's important. I think India benefits from globalization because India has a demographic dividend. It has a very young population in an aging world. So I think it's in India's benefit to keep global trade open. But by and large, it is not an export-oriented economy. I think in that sense, it is better off. And that's what Tom and I will talk about this tonight at the New York Public Library.
Well, with exports declining and that having an impact, where is India's economic growth likely to come from?
Well, it's going to come, I think, to a large extent from domestic markets. You have a young population. You have a savings rate of close to 35%. You have a huge internal market that needs to be satisfied. I think if we can get our things together, like our infrastructure, our education, and creating a single market in India, then there's a lot of growth potential within India itself.
What is the unemployment rate in India right now?
Well, it's you know, unemployment rate in India is difficult to figure out because
been very high.
Yeah, you know, because a lot of the employment itself is in the informal sector. Like 93% of India's workforce is in the informal sector. They're not in the formal labor. A lot of our labor force is in villages where they're underemployed, not necessarily unemployed. And so to some extent, the global slowdown has affected employment, especially in export-oriented industries. So there is some impact, but I wouldn't say it's as much as in some other countries.
When the eminent Indian historian Rabchandra Guha wrote that your book was an essential read to understand the policy issues facing India, it became the biggest nonfiction bestseller in India's history. Well, so people are concerned, obviously.
Well, yes, I think so. I think people are concerned because India is at the crossroads. It can either choose to grasp the brass ring and really take full advantage of this unusual opportunity it has because of its demographics and being a young country in an aging world. Or if it neglects to do the right things, then the same young population could turn out to be extremely disruptive. So I think the fact that we're at this crossroads has really made people think a lot about the future.
Well, you've been at a couple of crossroads, according to your book. You've divided it into four parts or ideas, and the first, called India Reimagined, deals with ideas that have arrived and taken hold, but with some resistance. How did Indians, for example, view computers at first?
No, actually, it's very fascinating because, you know, in the 1960s and 70s, Indians were very, very intimidated by technology. There were people who called computers as job-eating machines because they feared they would take away jobs. And in fact, a report on banking automation in the 80s didn't dare use the word computer. They called them as ledger posting machines, hoping that they would not excite too much of a reaction. But today, with a country with 8 million mobile phones a month being sold and 99% of the mobile phones being prepaid and the average recharge being 20 cents, I think there's a huge awareness that technology empowers people.
So there's been a real turnaround, because another thing that you talk about is that in polite Indian society, entrepreneurs have been looked down upon as predators.
Yes. I think what happened was, India got its independence from the British. And if you remember, the British before 1857 were actually a company. It was the British East India Company. And therefore, for a lot of Indians, imperialism and capitalism were entwined. And they felt that the best way to be a modern nation was to turn their backs on capitalism and give a less role for entrepreneurs.
What about colonialism and language? What role has the English language played in the post-colonial years?
That's also been very fascinating because when India got independence, people felt English should not stay because it was a foreign language. But India having hundreds of languages, a lot of the people in the South who didn't know the national language, Hindi, protested and made English stay. And today, with English enabling Indians to participate in the global economy, English has now become a language of aspiration. Even the poor want to learn English.
Another reason is that people of lower castes also hated Hindi for what it represented. But in China, Mao imposed Mandarin, and everybody has to speak Mandarin, even if they speak a local language.
Yes, and I don't think the Chinese have the language diversity that we have in India. We have India, we have literally hundreds of languages, which are, some of them are very different from each other. Also, I think this is the difference between a top-down country and a democracy. I think in India, even if the rulers wanted to impose one language, the people, sort of reacted to that and made sure it didn't happen.
My guest is Nandan Nilekani, who's written a book called Imagining India, The Idea of a Renewed Nation. It is published by Penguin. Another aspect of national identity is the enormous population growth, which was feared for many years. But unlike China, which imposed strict population control, India never had such a policy. Why?
Well, again, it goes back to democracy. There was a time in India in 1975 to 1977 when we had a period of suspended human rights, and we had something called the emergency.
And this grew out of Indira Gandhi.
Yes, it was the time of Indira Gandhi and her son, Sanjay Gandhi. And that was one time when the government tried to launch a huge coercive method of family planning. They went around and did sterilizations of many people. And in the elections in 77, they lost very badly because people didn't like this interference in their personal lives. And ever since then, family planning has not been coercive. But population rates have come down because of higher literacy, lower mortality, and so forth.
But you do cite one doctor who has made the Guinness Book of World Records for having performed 350,000 sterilizations. Is that possible?
Well, that's what he's supposed to have done. But I think, that was the time, that 75 to 77, there was a massive program to sterilize, people and reduce the population rate.
Hasn't India come to see its burgeoning population as a boon? What happened to make it become an asset?
Well, I think the reason why it started seeing population as an asset is that as the economy sort of opened up and people started getting jobs based on their skills, people started participating in the global economy through outsourcing, suddenly people realized that actually our people were asset. And that was coupled with the demographic dividend, which is, a lot of young people and huge working age population. So all these have brought together the notion that we have population as a human capital.
And you also make the case that China's population control was a big mistake for them.
Well, I think...
I mean, they still 1.5 billion people, don't they?
No, I think the point is that what happened with the one-child policy is that I think China was able to reap a demographic dividend much earlier. In fact, that's what they've been reaping for the last 30 years. But now they will have a period of rapid aging. brought upon by this policy. And also, I think just having one child has other consequences, you know, the female-male ratio goes down and so on and so forth. So I think there is a lot of unintended consequences of that kind of massive social engineering.
For many Americans, India, the burgeoning economy, really is represented by making a call to some American company to get some service and realizing that you're speaking to someone in Bangalore. And is that not export?
Yeah, that is
outsourcing what, is it, a form of export.
Yeah, outsourcing is definitely a form of export, and it's a form of outsourcing where you're using modern technology. So the person does not physically leave the country, but still services a global population. And certainly outsourcing has been an important part of the new India. But I think it's just one dimension of a very complex set of changes that are happening in this vibrant country.
Next month, India will hold its national elections. How many national elections have taken place in India since independence in 1947?
I don't recall the exact number, but you know, we've been having elections from 1951 onwards.
And what it's is the British system, so it isn't every 4 years or
no,
so.
It should be every 5 years, but you can have a midterm election, so you can have, you know, elections even after 2 years. But I think what is important about this election is that there are over 700 million voters. It's going to last for a month from April 16th. It's going to span the length and breadth of the country. It's going to be conducted entirely on electronic voting machines, over a million of them. So truly, this is the grandest democratic spectacle that you can see anywhere in the world.
In this country, we're lucky if we get 50% turnout. What kind of turnout in India?
Oh, India, it's more than that. It tends to veer towards more like 60%. And what's interesting in India is that the poor actually come out to vote much more than the rich, because the poor have realized that the vote is the only way that they can make governance accountable. So they take the vote very, very seriously, and that's what makes it so fascinating.
What is the likelihood that the Hindu Nationalist Party, the BJP, will be returned to power?
Well, I think your guess is as good as mine. I think.
Well, do polls indicate anything?
The current polls do indicate that the current Congress-led government has an edge over the others. But, you know, I think 5 years back, they said the same thing. They said the BJP would come back, and they did not. So I think it's very difficult to predict Indian elections.
Well, one of the problems is, I see it from just reading the New York Times, is that the BJP is very divisive, and many people fear that. On the other hand, there's been so much corruption with the Congress party that people aren't sure who they should vote for.
Well, I think, you know, Indian politics is very complicated, and I think people are becoming more and more aware of their requirements. I think there's a lot more development orientation. A lot of state politicians who did a lot of development have been voted back. So I think the party that promises good governance and development should do well.
And you say that really the change occurred when Rajiv Gandhi was prime minister?
So Rajiv Gandhi definitely played a big role because he was very young. He was forward-looking. I think because of him, we brought in computers and telecommunications into India. And also he was a big proponent of local self-government, Panchayati Raj, which is very important today.
Did things change after he was assassinated?
Well, his assassination was very, very unfortunate because it was on the verge of election. But the Congress-led government, which came into power in 91, actually then initiated these economic reforms, which today have helped in raising the rate of growth in India and helping to liberate its economy.
My guest is Nandan Nilekani, the co-chairman of Infosys Technologies Limited. He has received several awards, including the Joseph Schumpeter Prize for Innovative Services in Economy, Economic Sciences, and Politics. Listed as one of the 100 most influential people in the world by Time magazine in 2006 and was named Forbes Businessman of the Year for Asia in 2006. I guess the last 3 years have been a total waste, or they've been the time that he's been writing this book called Imagining India, The Idea of a Renewed Nation. It is published by Penguin. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. We're back with Nandan Nilekani, whose book, Imagining India, The Idea of a Renewed Nation, with a foreword by Thomas L. Friedman, is published by Penguin Press. and was the, or has been, or still is, the best-selling nonfiction book in the history of India.
Yeah, it's doing very well in India. It's very popular.
Written in English?
Oh, yeah, it's in English.
And did Tom Friedman do the introduction for the Indian edition as well?
No, basically Tom's introduction is for the global edition.
It used to be that India's most successful companies were family-run operations. Is that still true?
Well, they're certainly still very large and very well-known family-run operations. But I think the new thing in India in the last 20 years is the rise of the first-generation entrepreneur. And Infosys Technologies, which is the company which I co-founded, is an example of that, where professionals got together and created a global company.
When did India begin to move away from a generally socialist economy to a more capitalist one?
I think it began in 1991 when the government, of which the current Prime Minister Manmohan Singh was the finance minister, took a series of wide-ranging and dramatic economic reforms, which reduced the role of the state and gave business a freer hand to create companies and create wealth. And that led to the economic growth.
A listener wants to know about Narasimha Rao. He says, didn't he make all of the financial changes needed?
Well, Narasimha Rao was the prime minister when this happened. So clearly he provided the support and the political support for doing this. And Manmohan Singh was the finance minister under Narasimha Rao who implemented these changes.
The suggestion of my listener was that the Gandhi family under Sonia Gandhi has kind of resisted giving him credit because he was not a member of the family.
No, I think Narasimha Rao has been recognized for his contribution to India's economy.
Wasn't when the move was made away from the more socialist economy to a more capitalist approach, wasn't there some resistance from the Indian bureaucracy? For example, didn't you have problems getting licenses and importing things because of all the red tape?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I've talked about it in my book, which is that in the 80s, before liberalization, it would take us weeks and months to get a license, even to import a computer or the part of a computer. And I think one of the big achievements in the 90s was reducing this red tape, reducing the licensing, giving businesses a better hand at doing business and not spending their time meeting bureaucrats.
So things are better now?
Things are better. It can be even better because this, you know, making the economy efficient is a continuous exercise. But definitely, it's much, much better, much easier to do business in India today.
Isn't India damned if it does, damned if it doesn't? I remember, I think it was last year, it was announced that some car company was going to make a really inexpensive car, which would make it available to an awful lot of people who could never have had a car otherwise. And the response was, well, this is just going to add terribly to world pollution.
Yes. In fact, it's interesting because that car was launched just today in Mumbai. It was launched today, the Tata Nano. And I think it's a very complex thing because I think we cannot deny the aspirations of people and their desire for a better life. At the same time, I think as we look at a planet with 6 billion people going to 9 billion, we have to look at the carrying capacity of the planet and see how we adjust lifestyle. So I think India and other countries have to strike a balance between the aspirations of the people and the challenges of global overcrowding.
Isn't there another problem, and that is the entrenched attitudes of the past, trying to somehow adjust them to the current situation? For example, the caste system, which has persisted despite the fact that Mahatma Gandhi said we have to get rid of it. It was outlawed, I think, in the original Indian constitution. Yeah. And yet we hear about excesses all along.
Well, I think what happened was while we created a great democracy and, you know, one person, one vote and human rights for everyone, the politics created these vote banks. And those vote banks tended to align along caste lines, which is what is happening. Today we have many caste-based parties. But I do believe that the combination of education, English teaching, urbanization, and jobs in the formal sector will dissolve the concept of caste, because in a city, you really don't care who's sitting next to you.
Well, but India continues to have a terrible record when it comes to health and education of its children. An article in the New York Times a couple of years ago pointed out that 60 years after independence, with 40% of its population under 18, India is now confronting the perils of its failure to educate its citizens, notably the poor. Among children in fifth grade, 4 out of 10 could not read text at the second grade level. 7 out of 10 could not do subtraction.
Sure. I think you're quoting from the USER report, which studies education. I think that while it's true, I think there's a lot happening today. I think now every child in India and every parent has understood the value of education. So they're very keen that the children get educated. The government is spending a lot of money today on education. So while there's a lot to be done, I think the momentum has started. And I'm hopeful that in the next decade, we should see a lot more progress on literacy in India.
Although there has been a kind of a caste system in education as well, because India has been very proud of its system of higher education.
Yes, I think that's been one of India's contradictions. We have this wonderful higher education system. We have the IITs. I myself am from the IIT Bombay. But at the same time, we have not been that good in mass public primary education. And that's one of the contradictions that we need to address. I talk about that in my book as something we need to implement very quickly.
And also the healthcare of India's poor children.
Yes, healthcare is a challenge. In fact, today in India, 80% of healthcare spending is private spending. It's not in the public space. So a lot more has to be done to create universal public health facilities.
I've seen a documentary recently about children born with cleft palates. And finally, one hospital, which serves all of India, that does an operation to correct the problem free. But you have to get there.
Yes, I think you're talking about Smile Pinky, and the organization is called Smile Train. Well, I think they're doing a terrific job, and there are many people like that. There's a place called Arvind Eye Hospital, which is doing massive cataract operations around the country. There's Narayan Rudralaya, which is doing, you know, heart surgery by the thousands. So, but these are all individual examples of doing it, and I agree with you. We need to look at a much more larger public focus on this.
And not everyone can make the sacrifice of traveling great distances to get these services.
Oh, absolutely. I think providing high-quality health care across the country is a very important public requirement.
Since these things are done by private charities, it really says that the government has abdicated its role, doesn't it?
Well, health has not received the importance historically, but I must say, in credit of the current government, they have launched a major health program. It's called the National Rural Health Mission. And for the first time, you're seeing a huge focus on public health and health in rural areas.
My guest is Nandan Nilekani, whose book, Imagining India, The Idea of a Renewed Nation, is published by the Penguin Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Are there any side effects of the tremendous growth in India that worry you?
Oh, absolutely. I think one is on health. I think we run the risk of going from having a high level of malnutrition and other problems of the poor to the problems of the wealthy in terms of high obesity, high cardiac problems, high diabetes. And therefore, we have to make sure that we don't create a whole new set of lifestyle diseases. Similarly, we have to look at our pensions to make sure we don't create huge entitlements that we can't service tomorrow, as well as energy and environment, and make sure that, as you said, while the economy grows, at the same time we address the problem of energy and global warming.
This is a problem for all emerging nations, isn't it? And I know in South America, many Brazil, for example, has complained that it's easy for us to say, the more advanced nations, that they shouldn't pollute the air, they shouldn't destroy the Amazon, whatever. Because we already did it ourselves. We're saying, do as I say, not as I do.
Well, I think this is the challenge for developing countries because, you know, compared to the rich nations, their populations are much larger. The pace of growth is much higher. They have full democracy, so people have a vote. So it's very, very complex to ensure economic growth and prosperity, at the same time address the challenges of the environment. And I think these countries are trying very hard to manage both.
It was surprising, given the recent terrorism in India and that you serve on the World Economic Forum, that your book does not address the security and terrorist threat in your country. Why not?
Well, I think, for one, you know, I wrote the book before this terrorist threat. But more importantly,
but Kashmir has been a problem.
Yeah, but I think, you know,
time.
I think, you know, there are challenges in India. There are challenges of security. There are challenges of governance. And I have talked about these challenges. My real purpose of this book was to show Indians and to show the world that India had this phenomenal opportunity. And, you know, it's our either we could take it and create a much better nation, or we could lose it. And certainly the focus is on that.
Well, since religious tensions continue to plague India, isn't that something that the country's going to have to get past?
Well, I think, you know...
We see people going on rampages and killing neighbors.
Well, I think, you know, what you see on TV will... you know, there are some incidents, but I think on the scale of the fact that you have a billion people, I think by and large, they are living in a peaceful environment. But I think, you know, as long as we have political divisiveness, whether it's by religion, by caste, you know, you're bound to have some of these things erupt in the public domain.
Along with the historian Ramachandra Guha, you're a trustee of the New India Foundation. What kind of work does the foundation do?
Well, you know, Ramachandra Guha, who's really the driving force behind this, felt that there was not enough research being done on post-independent India, because he felt the most fascinating things happening in India were actually in the last 60 years after independence. So we provide fellowships and scholarships and other things to encourage people to write on diverse topics of post-independent India.
I love some of the little details that you come up with. For example, Indira Gandhi's aside to a visiting writer while she waved at a crowd that was adoring her, she said, "Do get me some more of those cashew nuts, or you have no idea how tiring it is to be a goddess."
Yes, I think, you know, I think early independent India, the leaders were treated, you know, with great, you know, great devotion. I remember as a child going to see Pandit Jawaharlal Nehru, the founder of modern India. And
Her father.
And the crowds were just ecstatic to see him. So I think there was a great amount of promise and hope. And some of that went down in the 70s and 80s. But I think I see a revival of the promise of India now, and that's why I wrote this book.
But we do see something similar all throughout Asia, don't we, where certain people, certain families become so prominent that they seem to rise above the normal folks, almost to godlike status?
Well, I think clearly some families in India, it's the Nehru Gandhi family, have achieved that kind of status. But I think Indian politics is becoming much more competitive. We are seeing a lot more leaders today. Their leaders are in other parties. Their leaders are in new parties. So Indian politics is very, very competitive, very thriving, very democratic.
And does the success of a movie like Slumdog Millionaire make Indians proud, or does it embarrass them a bit?
Well,
because so much of the focus is on the poverty aspect.
I think they are ambivalent because I think they do find that the focus on poverty and the slums and some of it looks very cliché to them. At the same time, the fact that Indian artists like A.R. Rahman and Rasool and all these other people have won individual Oscars makes them proud that Indian creativity is now recognized on the global stage.
Does your business run itself, or do you still have to go in and spend a fair amount of time in the office when you're not writing a book or talking on talk shows?
Well, you know, I must tell you that I wrote this book on weekends and in the evenings, so I didn't do it at the cost of my work, which I do a day's work at my office.
I want to thank you so much for being with us today. Nandan Nilekani, who is the co-founder of the IT company Infosys, and author now of Imagining India, the Idea of a Renewed Nation, published by the Penguin Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Leonard. Thank you for having me.